For this morning is United States versus Charles Stokes, case number 112734. Mr. DeCastro?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. And please the court, my name is Pablo DeCastro. I am here for Mr. Charles Todd Stokes. Your Honor, I know you've read the briefs. You know how complicated the case became and how many issues eventually arose. I think the only way to sum it all up in the brief time we have today is to bring it down to this is the story of what happened. Mr. Stokes was an American citizen living in Thailand, as I'm sure you know. He was living there since 2000. He flew home for Christmas in 2001 and went back in 2002. It wasn't until several months later that U.S. ICE agents in Thailand began to hear rumors that this individual may have a sexual interest in minors. There was not specific information about going out and actually indulging these interests, just that there had been questionable behavior at some of the places where he worked, that people had their suspicions about him. That's as far as it went. They followed him and kept him under investigation for 10 months and found nothing, saw nothing, talked to nobody who'd actually seen him engage in any sex with any minors, but they were dying to find more. They called in help from the Royal Thai Police, who also surveilled him and found nothing.
The
U.S. ICE agents, Agents Phillips, Paisarn, and Som Sri.
Did they have a contingent over there? Is this a normal thing?
Yes.
Or is this for
apparently they do, Your Honor. And in fact, agent, and this is also partly relevant, Mr. Phillips was the only one in the team who was Caucasian. The other two were Thai nationals, born and raised, who were employed as ICE agents for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They were U.S. Employees, U.S. agents, working in a contingent in Bangkok, specifically directed at finding U.S. citizens guilty of sex crimes in Thailand. Now, part of this is a response, and this is also interesting, is a response to the introduction of 18 U.S.C. 2324C, which was a new law in 2004, I believe, that criminalizes travel to another country and thereafter engaging in sex with minors. This was part of the PROTECT Act. This kicked in a heightened drive to investigate cases such as this. There was probably a suspicion that Mr. Stokes may be guilty for this offense. They didn't figure out until a long time later that the last flight they could put him on was 2002, which predated the enactment of 2423C, so he couldn't be charged with that. What happened was in 2003 they got a search warrant for drugs, ostensibly, with no evidence whatsoever to support
that. Didn't it refer to drugs and other illegal items?
The warrant says drugs and other illegal items.
Isn't that pretty broad?
Well, the Thai officer who testified specified that implicated other items that were violations of Thai law. He also said that nothing he found in the house, including all the photographs, gave him any reason to arrest Mr. Stokes under Thai law. So what the U.S. agents were looking for was beyond the scope of the warrant, was beyond the scope of the permission granted by the Thai court. They knew as much going into it. They had every intention of searching, as Agent Paisarn and Agent Phillips both admitted, searching for evidence relevant to their own investigation. They were not searching for drugs. They were not searching in places where drugs could be found. They were looking for evidence relevant to their investigation.
Your argument about the warrant presupposes that the warrant clause applies here.
Sure it does, Your Honor. Under reasonableness, it still has to be reasonable. And if you hang your reasonableness on we had the authority of a Thai court, well, then you should also be limited to the authority that's granted.
I think the reasonableness argument here is based on the existence of probable cause.
Yes. Probable cause to conduct the type of search that they conducted. And I don't believe they had any. They were looking for more. They wanted to find more evidence. They wanted to justify. They wanted to see if they could find anything in there. But they had no reason to suspect they would find anything. Nothing that would rise to the level of probable cause in this country.
I thought they had information from the school.
They had information from a school that he had been fired because the school found out that in Florida he'd had a prior prosecution for a sex crime against a child, and so they fired him. They also indicated that they were suspicious of some of his behavior, but they were not specific. There were no complaints filed. There were no witnesses interviewed.
I thought there were statements from people who knew him that he had underage boys living with him.
There was a statement from somebody who worked with him who said, yeah, he told me he had a kid living with him. But whether this person suspected that was a sexual relationship or not, this person never claimed to know. This person said, I heard he has a kid living with him. Could be a kid that was cleaning the house, could be anything. They were suspicious of him, certainly, but it was their suspicion was based on, in part, their misunderstanding of his criminal record in Florida. In fact, in Florida, he'd been found guilty of a misdemeanor battery, which was reduced from a sexual allegation. So when he denied in his initial application that he had any such criminal background, and it came out later that he did, he was confronted with it and he was fired. In retrospect, they looked at all his behavior and they said, you know what, I think the guy was kind of creepy. And that's as much as the ICE agents had. They didn't really have
a teacher who had worked with him said more, didn't he?
He said
he mentioned having a boy or two living with him and commented that he, quote, liked them very young.
There was the liked them very young comment, but that is open to a lot of interpretation. His own girlfriend at the time was 20 years old.
It doesn't have to be conclusive to be probable cause, right?
He was a 40-something-year-old man who had an open relationship with a girlfriend at the time who was 23. And it could have been a reference to that.
Could have been.
It's a conclusion that this guy was drawing, and a conclusion that the ICE agents were drawing. But as I said, it's chasing rumors. They don't have any hard evidence of anything at this point. They're certainly curious about him, though, and they certainly want to get into his house. And so they manage that with the help of the Royal Thai Police. And they get in there. They find all these pictures. And what's interesting is he's not charged. He's not arrested for anything under Thai law, anything under U.S. law. For 3 more years, the U.S. worked on getting the request for extradition and the provisional arrest warrant. For 3 years, they toyed around with what the charges were going to be. And when he was arrested in 2006, the charges were aggravated kidnapping, the charges were forced rape, the charges were all sorts of things that Mr. Stokes had a legitimate argument in the extradition proceedings that there was no evidence to support these charges. The charges were amended several times, ultimately landing on 2423C, which, as we've already discussed, was unviable. The extradition went through, and he went to Florida. That charge was dismissed. He was brought to Chicago and charged with possession of pornography, which, again, was unviable because none of the pornography ever was possessed in the U.S. There was no use of the Internet. There was no tie to the United States, no jurisdictional tie. So, again, that charge was dismissed, and he was finally charged with 2423B. It took from 2003, when the search occurred, to 2007, when he was finally charged with 2423B, and the way somebody in the prosecution team finally came up with this was, you know, I know what we can do. We'll use 2423B, and we'll say that being a pedophile is the same thing as having a specific intent to have sex with minors on a specific day. He had sex with minors before the trip, and he had sex with minors after the trip, and therefore, he had the intent to have sex with minors on the day of the trip. This depends on two things. First of all, the factual premise that he had sex with minors both before and after. And on that factual premise, the government did a very interesting thing at trial. Because the use of the photographs was so limited, they told the jury that there were 6,000 photographs. They put in the mind of the jury, for example, 6,000 playing cards, if you can imagine, with their face down, turned over a few of them, 12 or 15, I think, and then told the jury the rest are all like that. They weren't, as it turns out, like that. Agent Sapper testified all of the individuals in all of the 6,000 photographs were minors, not a single adult, which is not true. Agent Sapper testified that this activity occurred day in and day out, which is not true. It was on average every 3 weeks. Sometimes months would go by. Sometimes it'd be 2 weekends in a row. But the dates were there in the metadata, which was not provided to the defense until the day or two before trial, which was coded and not really useful without reference to the photos, which we didn't look at. Now,
these were the defendant's own photos. This is information that was presumably this was information that presumably was available to him.
And he had been telling his defense lawyer prior to me and me that these were not all minors, that some of them, you know, he admitted in his testimony, some of them were too young, and he admitted that. But what his narrative, his story that he wanted to tell was that this was behavior that sort of that he fell into over time. It was not his intention when he first moved there. He admitted shamefully that he had these urges and that they slowly took over, and then he started having sex with younger and younger looking prostitutes. He wanted to make this case, and I don't know about his previous attorney, but I certainly didn't have the time to sit down and go over these 6,000 photographs with him. After the trial, we did that, and it took several days at the U.S. Attorney's Office to do so. And after doing it, we realized there was impeachment there. There was impeachment of Agent Sapper's testimony with respect to the frequency, with respect to the ages of the individuals. There were certain photographs used at trial that showed certain individuals from certain angles that excluded other photographs of the same individuals that would have different markers of age, musculature, tattoos.
Counsel, I don't see where you're going with this line of argument, because if the quarrel is over the frequency of the misconduct with minors, the molestation of minors, when he admitted doing it repeatedly,
but
the frequency hardly
matters.
Whether
he did it before and after 2002, whether he did it before the flight and after the flight, which was the whole theory of prosecution was he did it before and after, therefore he had the intent on the day.
Right,
I don't think factually that was proven, number one. Number two, there's a logical conclusion here that doesn't fly either, that even if he did it before and after, that does not suffice for proof of intent on a particular day.
There's a very reasonable and logical inference to be drawn from the before and after evidence.
Well, the same inference then would lead to the conclusion that on the day he's released from prison in Colorado after serving his 15 years, on that day when he travels back to Florida to his family home, on that day he'll be guilty of the same thing.
Depending on what happens afterwards.
Well, they're saying that he's a pedophile and who traveled. So this statute, as used in this case, criminalizes traveling while being a pedophile, traveling while belonging to a certain class of people, not traveling with a specific intent. It's been misinterpreted and overly broadly interpreted in this case, because having done something on day one and having done something on day three doesn't mean you have the intent to do it on day two. It does show that you are capable of it. It shows predisposition, and predisposition is relevant in some sex cases, and it is admissible to show predisposition. It is not admissible as a substitute for proof of intent.
You're saying travel with intent, just to engage in illicit sexual conduct, I guess, is the charge or whatever.
Yes.
That's the crime. And you're saying it has to be that day? You may have... I don't want to
you don't have to
hypothetical,
intend.
But I guess what you're saying is he has to have, that's his only reason for travel.
It doesn't have to be his only reason, I would admit.
Why does it have
it
to be the same day, not the next day or the day before?
According to the case law, it has to be a dominant purpose.
Has to be what?
A dominant purpose for initiating the travel. He initiated the travel to go back home where he had been living and working, and he had built a home, and he was engaged to be married and all sorts of other things. He came to the United States in part to arrange for the shipment of all his last belongings over there to make the move final and permanent. And whether this sort of general predisposition to this type of sexual behavior and his belief that this was okay in Thailand might have been a motivator for moving there, that may be in a general sense, and it may be that he has a general predisposition towards this sort of sexual behavior, but it does not follow that he had the specific intent on a particular day to do so. If it does, if you use the one to substitute for the other, then you're criminalizing travel by a class of people.
What would you need? If behavior before and after is not enough, a pattern like this, what would it take? A diary entry or a letter?
Every other case prosecuted 2423B shows emails, communications, prior preparatory acts, packing a bag full of condoms on your before you take the trip, making arrangements with specific providers of minors for purposes of prostitution ahead of time, making arrangements with a particular brothel or madam. There were prosecutions for people who set up hotels in Mexico specifically for the purpose. Now, these things are proof of your intent prior to traveling. You set it up ahead of time. You set it up ahead of time. You send these letters. There is proof. All they've proven in this case is that Unfortunately, yeah, he's a pedophile. He likes this stuff. He proved that himself. He said so himself.
This sounds like a jury argument to me.
Hmm?
This sounds like a jury argument to me.
Well, Your Honors, arguably, it should never have gone to a jury. I think the whole purpose of sending it to a jury was in the hopes that they would see a few pictures and they would sharpen their pitchforks and light up their torches and go after him. That's the whole point here. What's interesting about this argument about intent is that it took them so long, even for the government to think of it. It's not obvious. It's not obvious that before and after equals intent. If it were, he'd have been charged with 2423B from the beginning, which he wasn't. They didn't even think of it until after they tried 2423C, after they tried pornography, after they tried forcible rape, all these other charges that were attached and dismissed and withdrawn. And finally they lit upon this one and they thought, you know what, this just might work if. And that if is not obvious. It was not obvious to them, no matter how adamant they've argued that it is obvious.
So you're saying he had many reasons to travel to Thailand, most, you know, this might be his final move, maybe, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And having this, we'll call it inclination or whatever, bad habit, it was just one of many reasons to go. So you're saying that dilutes his intent, and therefore this shouldn't be charged.
What I'm saying is that the definition... The limits of where you define intent have to be drawn somewhere. And at some point, it turns into a prosecution for being a certain class of person. And at some point, and I think in this case, it's gone beyond that point. I see my light is on, so I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you. Mr. DeVote?
Good morning. Andrew, may it please the Court. Andrew DeVote on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, this morning I'd like to address what I see as the two issues the defendant, I'd like to focus on the two issues that defense counsel, appellant raised on his argument, and those deal with the search warrant and facts surrounding lead up to the search warrant, and then what I understood essentially is a sufficiency of the evidence argument. I think that the questions that Your Honor asked regarding the probable cause idea is correct. I think here that there is no extraterritorial application of the warrant clause of the Fourth Amendment based on the Supreme Court's decision, the Second Circuit's decision. And there was an extensive evidentiary hearing in terms of the reasonableness of this search. There was a 3-day evidentiary hearing. The district court's opinion, its record, it's number 112 in the record. The opinion sets out there was more than just rumor here. There was more than just speculation. There were, in fact, comments from different teachers. There were comments relaying statements he had made. There were observations of young boys going to and from his building when he lived in one location, and then when the Royal Thai Police searched, observations of boys coming and going as well. And it was litigated extensively. The 3-day hearing, the judge actually got to watch as well, to watch most of the search itself by way of a video of the search. And Your Honors, in terms of the scope of the search warrant, the language was in order to locate and seize any illegal items and narcotics. And the defense struggled mightily in the trial court, and again before this court, to characterize this as some sort of underhanded conduct by United States law enforcement officials to get this warrant, to go through back channels. That's not what happened. The record demonstrates as much. The district court's final factual findings show as much, that there was an investigation ongoing with these different types of evidence, that investigation was discussed with the Royal Thai Police, that Colonel Thong Suk testified at one of the evidentiary hearings that he went to the Thai court, that he obtained the search warrant, and that he himself relied on the evidence that he had put together to get that warrant.
Now, who's he?
Colonel Thong Suk. He was the commander of the narcotics unit for the police in Pattaya, which is the city that the defendant moved to, Your Honor, at a certain point.
So he's a Thai?
He is, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, I was sort of curious about the relationship with whoever the Thai authorities are and ICE.
Yes, Your Honor. So what ended up happening is that when the investigation was initially in Bangkok, ICE officials were conducting their investigation. The defendant moved to Pattaya, which my understanding is it's approximately 200 kilometers from Bangkok, and with traffic, it was a tremendous drive. So they requested the assistance of the Royal Thai Police to conduct surveillance, and they conducted that surveillance. They asked the narcotics unit, not because they were staging some sort of false pretense of a drug investigation, but because, as is laid out in the brief and in the judge's opinion, because this was one unit in Pattaya that had plainclothes officers that conducted surveillance. It was the one unit in that town that conducted this type of operation. And the ICE officials testified, they were cross-examined by counsel about the information they had, about the information that they relayed, and what they understood the search would be.
Who initiated the search?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Who initiated the search?
Colonel Thongsuk went. There's no testimony that the ICE folks requested, please go get this warrant. The Thai officers, conducted their surveillance. They contacted ICE officials and let them know they had obtained the warrant. And they articulated and were subject to cross-examination about that process and their having gone to get that warrant, and testified that they were not instructed by ICE officials to go get this warrant.
When was he put under surveillance?
Your Honor, that was in, it would have been 2002. After his return to the States,
returned back to Thailand.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he was given permission by his Florida probation agent to move to Thailand in the first place?
He was, Your Honor. I think maybe if they had to do it again, they would not. But I think the district court was absolutely right. There was, looking at reasonableness, there was probable cause here. And then the second component of that reasonableness examination, the function of that, of the carrying out of the search, it was reasonable. When you balance that notion of the government need versus the privacy of the individual, the judge got to see the video herself of that search and hear from each of these individuals get cross-examined on the nature of that search.
Was Stokes subject to prosecution in Thailand?
Your Honor, he was. There was testimony that having sex or committing sex acts with underage kids is a crime. Colonel Thongsuk testified to that. He was never prosecuted. He was never charged. But he was asked point blank at one of the hearings. I know there was a reference to this idea of nothing in the house that he could be charged with. He was asked at one of the evidentiary hearings point blank, and I believe we even said it in our opinion, or excuse me, in our brief. I apologize. The idea that he was asked, is having sex with underage children a crime in Thailand? Yes. And so we found these pictures of this body. Although the U.S. ended up charging, there certainly could have been an investigation of, was that him committing the sex act? Was that his penis? Was that the semen on those little boys' faces and their chests? And you can tell from the pictures as well that those acts took place in this house. And I think that leads to the second argument, this idea of specific intent on this particular day. And respectfully, that's just not correct. Absolutely every case has different types of evidence to prove intent. And it is a jury argument. And it may be a spectrum of evidence, and the farther you go away from the operative date, it may be that your argument gets weaker. But in this response to defense counsel's argument that we were twisting and turning the evidence of only showing the jury a couple pictures, it's a little disingenuous, because the government, and this isn't self-congratulatory, this is just an important fact for your honors, the government exercised restraint on purpose, and it only showed the jury a few pictures, and it only showed the jury pictures from some particular months, which is pretty telling. November 2001, December 2001. He travels back December 2001 and comes back January 2002. And so the other pictures then that they ended up showing were January 2002 and February. They originally had a sample that came from like September 2001 to, I believe, in early 2003. But there was 19 pictures. They cut that down to 10 pictures on their own to focus in on the operative time frame, because with the understanding that they're trying to prove intent when he boarded that airplane and went back to Thailand. And it's certainly not irrational or unreasonable for a jury to have found that he had that specific intent. And that's the standard on appeal. The defense counsel was able to make these arguments. He was able to cross-examine the witnesses. And he was able to make this point that on that particular day, this was in his head. Additionally, you know, this idea of the standard of dominant versus substantial, it is true it doesn't have to be his only purpose. But when you look at the evidence in this case, I mean, no matter what the standard is, the court in McGuire, which is in this line of cases and the statute, suggested in the future the standard should be, but for the sex act, would they take this trip? And I think even under that standard, the evidence here would meet that. But here, the jury instruction was appropriate. It matched a jury instruction that's been affirmed by this court, and that the reason of travel, it was a substantial reason for the travel. And that evidence that was presented, the government exercised restraint in what it showed and really tried to focus on the issues. It did reference the fact that there were a number of photos. But that, Your Honors, dealt with establishing that when you talk about him moving from Florida to Thailand in the first instance. I mean, the house that he created was a haven for this activity. And he went back to that haven because he had found his refuge. And therefore, the jury verdict was not unreasonable.
Are there other crimes that where American citizen travels to another country, travel with intent to do something criminal? Are there other crimes besides this type?
Your Honors, I stand here. I have to say I'm not 100% sure. Defense counsel is correct to point out that
for more than 200 years, it's been a crime under U.S. law to engage in the slave trade anywhere in the world for any U.S. national. There's never been any doubt about that. Although I confess that I did wonder about whether, for example, a visitor, somebody who travels to the Netherlands with the intent of smoking Cuban cigars or marijuana might be criminalized under
U.S. law. And I think that Congress would make that policy decision, but I think the same, in theory, the same idea would apply. But I think that here, he boarded this airplane, he traveled in both interstate and international commerce, and he had that intent. The evidence was very, very strong at trial.
Was he still on probation when he reentered Thailand?
Your Honor, his probation ended in 2000. So when he came back to Thailand in 2002, he was no longer on probation. His probation, my understanding, was 1 year, or maybe it was 2 years, but it expired in May of 2000, Your Honor. So it was not in the operative travel date.
Can I ask you about the rule of specialty, which is one of these rather esoteric issues that I haven't confronted before?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you help me try to reconcile the Supreme Court's decisions in Rauscher and in Alvarez? Rauscher saying a violation of the rule of specialty results in dismissal of the charges, and Alvarez saying it's okay to kidnap a defendant from a foreign country and bring him here.
Your Honor, I think this goes to counsel's point of raising this argument. I think that, first of all, starting with this court's decisions, a lot of courts have looked to Rauscher and viewed Rauscher as giving an individual that right to raise this statute. Mm-hmm. And I think that this court is, as we were upfront about it, this court is one of the few courts that has not, in fact, decided explicitly that an individual can raise this right.
Oh, we said quite explicitly one cannot.
Right.
So,
and I think
that's difficult to reconcile with Rauscher.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. In all candor, I think a prime example, if this court won it, two things. I think if this court revisited it, I think a good example is Puentes. I think the 11th Circuit's decision is concise. It's a 1995 decision. I think it's insightful, and I think its analysis of Rauscher is helpful. But that said, I don't think the court needs to go there in this case for the very reason of the waiver. I mean, whether it's Rauscher or any other decision, when we look at the treaty, Your Honor, the extradition treaty, the very document that creates the possibility of this argument, that within that same article, Article 14, it goes on to say that this rule does not apply if the country waives. And every court, even the courts that have said an individual may raise this right, for example, the Ninth Circuit, the 11th Circuit, now the Third Circuit, they've all gone on to say that the nature of this right is based on the comity between the nations. And therefore, even though we find an individual has standing to raise this argument, given the nature of the right and that it truly belongs to the countries, if the country waives it, that individual's ability is curtailed. And you see that in the specifics of this treaty.
You may have looked more broadly than I have. Mr. DeVote and counsel for the defense may have as well. But since Rauscher, I did not find any cases under the rule of specialty that a defendant actually won. This circuit court seemed to have found plenty of different theories for upholding convictions, some of them mutually inconsistent with each other, but everybody seemed to find ways to uphold the convictions.
I think that's right. And, Your Honor, it's interesting. Again, the 11th Circuit is a helpful example because what they say in their opinion is, in Puentes, many times we've had this come before us. And we've never had to squarely address it because what they've done is, and frankly I think could be done here as well, is they have assumed an individual can raise it, but the argument that the individual raises, or when they go to the actual other terms of the treaty and try to say for this reason or that reason it violates this rule, there's been no merit to that argument. And so that's why I think, you know, that's what you tend to see. And in Puentes they said, finally, we actually have to squarely address it here. They ultimately found for the government, but the argument was substantive enough that it wasn't one on its face that, well, we don't even need to decide whether or not he can raise it because it has no merit. And obviously we see courts do that on a lot of issues where they say assuming but not deciding and then going to the next issue. And I think here that, I mean, frankly, I think that's what is appropriate. If the court wanted to revisit Burke, it could, but I don't think that it's necessary or possibly appropriate given that once we go on to the merits of this issue, we see this clear waiver. And there's nothing underhanded about this waiver. I think what's telling in Uribe, which is a Ninth Circuit case, the court talked about, given the nature of this right, countries can decide to waive for whatever reason they choose. And there's nothing unseemly about that. It's because of the nature of the right, which is based on comedy.
What is the Fuentes decision?
Fuentes, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Fuentes is just a decision that I, frankly, in learning the issue myself, I found helpful. It's 50 F3rd 1567. And it was just a discussion of, you know, it was a court saying this is the first time we've looked at this issue and had to decide what we make of Rauscher. And that's why, as someone learning the issue, I found helpful. So,
thank you.
Mm-hmm. But I think the district court correctly found that the search was reasonable. And I think, you know, secondly, there was more than enough evidence here. The jury was not unreasonable. And to the rule of specialty, I think the court, if it wanted to revisit Burke, it could, but it doesn't have to because the very merits of the treaty.
With regard to the waiver, the Thai waiver, I look at this crime and what this guy did. It seemed to me they have a much bigger interest in this person and what he's been doing than we do. I realize there's a crime, and this is a lot of crimes, and this is one that can be prosecuted, but it seems that this is kind of a reach to get this guy as opposed to the Thai folks doing what ought to be done, and they got the problem there, and this is one of the perpetrators of the problem. What's our problem with this, other than the fact that he's from here?
Well, we have an American citizen, Your Honor, molesting dozens of boys, young boys, and who also committed this conduct in the United States. And you're right, there's certainly Thailand has an interest. But I think that really comes back to, I don't disagree with that at all, Your Honor, but I think that the U.S. government has a right as well. We have the statute. It applies. The evidence shows it applies. And that was a diplomatic discussion that Thailand and the United States had. And they're entitled to have that, obviously, to have that discussion. And this treaty, this very treaty, provides for that sort of interaction. And there's nothing in the treaty that suggests, you know, one country has preference over another. This is really is, again, that comedy, that idea, this discussion between the two countries. And defense counsel, again, in the trial court, tried to paint that as there being something underhanded. But the Thai government knew the facts. The treaty requires that information be presented to each government, that they have certain materials. I believe it's Article 3 or 4. And they made that decision to waive and to allow the U.S. to extradite this person and prosecute him. And I think that the U.S., if Thailand could have done it, but so could the U.S. And I think that that's the most important point from our perspective in litigating this case. And for those reasons, I would ask the court, if you have no further questions, to affirm the jury's verdict and the court's sentence.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. DeCastro. You have 3.5 minutes.
Thank you. quickly, just about the rule of speciality in your questions about Rauscher and the procedure. I think the difference, what Rauscher demands is that once the charge is dismissed here, that he be released and allowed to go back to the country from which he was extradited. And the reason for this, I believe, is that once there, if you initiate a new extradition proceeding for the new charge, he can participate in that proceeding. He can object to it. He can argue.
But why isn't Thailand's waiver sufficient?
Because he was not given the opportunity to participate or weigh in, and he was never even shown what representations were made by the U.S. government to the Thai government to get that waiver. The Thai government's statement of waiver indicates that they were somehow under the impression that 2423B is only technically different than 2423C, which I would argue is a misrepresentation probably made or understood in that communication between the two governments.
There's case law. Some of the case law in this area suggests, I mean, clearly if you're charged in a completely different episode, an entirely different criminal episode, there would be a problem. Where you're talking about essentially the same course of conduct, and
sorry.
Where you're talking about essentially the same course of conduct and a fairly subtle change in the elements of the crime, I would agree that sometimes it might be decisive, but still, Surely the Thai officials could not have been shocked at the shift from 2423C to B.
But doing it this way took from Mr. Stokes the opportunity to ask the Thai government himself, please don't extradite me, they don't have evidence of this.
Well, so what?
He had that right. He fought for a year in Thailand. When they finally settled on 2423C, he lost that argument, but it's a different argument with 2423G. And he never had the right to make that argument because nobody mentioned 2423B until he was already here. So he didn't have the right to participate in that. And although the U.S.
Would you agree that his right is dependent upon the treaty?
Yes, and his right is to petition the Thai government, not the U.S. government.
Okay,
and he wasn't given that.
But if his rights derive from the treaty, he's claiming to be a kind of third-party beneficiary of the contract, in essence, right?
Well, I suppose you can.
And if the two parties decide to modify their contract, does he have a claim?
According to Rauscher, he does.
The British government objected, didn't it?
But you also asked whether Rauscher had been upheld or used any more recently in the Seventh Circuit. And I think there was a case in 2007, Jogi versus Voges, that was a Seventh Circuit case that used Rauscher. They weren't talking about this particular treaty provision, but they were saying the treaties do create rights enforceable by individuals.
That was the Vienna Convention on consular rights, right?
Well, yes.
Different treaty.
It was a Vienna Convention issue, but the point is it was clearly stated that the international treaty can create a right enforceable by the individual. The reason is there's no other way to enforce it. He has to be able to raise his hand and say, wait a minute, I want to talk to the Thai government about this. And he never got to do that.
Well, sure there's a way for him to be able to do that, which is to ask the Thai government to protest. Right?
He's sitting in jail in the United States. He's supposed to call Amnesty International and ask them to go to Thailand. That's a U.S. organization doing exactly the opposite, arguing for U.S. citizens in custody in other places. There's nobody who's going to go over to Thailand for him. He had an attorney in Thailand, but there was no proceeding, there was no court, there was nowhere for that attorney to make his voice heard. He had an attorney in Thailand who went to NYU, who was familiar with both U.S. and Thai law, who fought for a year about this extradition. And when they finally lost, nobody was talking about 2423B. And if they were, he had a competent attorney there. And he could have participated in that process. He was not allowed to do that.
But if the Thai extradition treaty...
He wasn't even allowed to review the process.
The point is that if the Thai extradition treaty waived this rule, then that modifies the underlying rule to his detriment. And
counsel,
so
it'll help if you let her finish her question.
I apologize.
Okay. The rule has been modified by waiver. And it has been modified to your client's detriment so that his reliance on the underlying rule doesn't carry any weight, or attempt to rely on it doesn't carry any weight, since it has been modified by the extradition treaty specifically with Thailand, which contains the waiver. So there isn't anything there anymore, Rauscher notwithstanding.
I understand your point, Your Honor, and I can only reiterate that the reason I think that Rauscher still matters, the reason is that it's supposed to give the defendant, the individual, the right to participate in that request for waiver. A waiver obtained without any input from the most affected party, without even any review. We've asked repeatedly to look at these letters. We haven't even been allowed to look at them. So where do we challenge it? Do we challenge it here? Do we challenge it there? There can be no challenge because of the way it was done. One country whispering in the other country's ear doesn't do anything for Mr. Stokes.
But we also know that kidnapping is perfectly okay, right?
Which, again, I agree with you. I find it hard to reconcile that, and I disagree with it, but it's not my issue here. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.